Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Anna Tsing is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She has a BA from Yale University and a master's and PhD from Stanford. She received a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2010, and in 2013, she won a Niels Bohr Professorship at Aarhus University in Denmark for her contribution to interdisciplinary work in the fields of natural sciences, social sciences, and the arts. Recent books by Chinese-American anthropologist Anna Tsing are Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet and her award-winning book, The Mushroom at the End of the World, on the possibilities of life in capitalist ruins. This book explores alternative prospects for living within and through the disasters wrought by capitalism. It describes the globalized commodity chains that exist around the Matsutake mushrooms that only grow in human-disturbed forests. Anna Tsing, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, now that's quite a title, The Mushroom at the End of the World, on the possibilities of life in capitalist ruins. Why did you write this book?
I wrote the book because I became fascinated about this Matsutake mushroom. It's at least sometimes the most expensive mushroom in the world and much loved, especially in Japan and Korea.
Now, when you say most expensive, is it something like $50 a pound?
Well, it depends. That's why I said sometimes. The ritual of buying the first mushroom can be one mushroom costs $1,000 or something. But after that, the things settle down. Then it depends on where the mushrooms are from. In the Pacific Northwest, the price that's paid to buyers nowadays rarely goes over $50 a pound. But $50 a pound to to pickers is really quite a good price. Often it's much lower than that, and sometimes it's up to $75 a pound. But we're still talking about pickers, not consumers. So by the time it gets to Asia, it's quite a bit higher.
Now you say gets to Asia. We would think that we get them from Asia with the name like Matsutake. But you're saying that these are picked here in the Northwest.
That's right. In fact, some people call them pine mushrooms or even tan oak mushrooms because they grow with our pines and tan oaks here in Northern California as well as in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. And people started sending them to Japan quite a long time ago. The Japanese Americans who came to the Pacific Northwest found these mushrooms and started sending them to their relatives. But after the Chernobyl accident in the Ukraine, when the European mushrooms were too radioactive for people to use, commercial mushroom picking came to the Pacific Northwest. And then as part of that, in the late 1980s, all kinds of pickers started to gather in the Pacific Northwest to look for this mushroom, which is, many kinds of mushrooms are picked commercially in the Pacific Northwest, but this one is the most specialized and has the highest price, and so the one that has the most excitement about it among pickers.
My guest is Anna Tsing. She's an anthropologist, and she has written a book about this special mushroom, the mushroom at the end of the world. Now, a friend of mine told me that in her yard there's this tree growing that has mushrooms at the root of the tree, and she was told, that's going to be detrimental to the tree to have these mushrooms growing there. And I understand that this mushroom that you're talking about, has an affinity for a particular kind of tree.
But far from detrimental, it's mushrooms that make trees grow. In fact, all of the trees that make forests for us, like the oaks and the pines, they depend on the mushrooms to live. Because without the fungi, these trees, they can't really gather food for themselves. It's the mushrooms that attach onto the roots, and they put these long strings of fungal bodies out there gathering water and nutrients that they bring to the tree. And in exchange, they get the carbohydrates from the tree. So you could see it as mushrooms farming trees, perhaps, because they're getting their meals from these trees, but they're also bringing all kinds of nutrients and water to the trees. So trees really need mushrooms.
Well, how do you explain to somebody what this mushroom is like? If you're a new picker and you go out, I'm sure you go with other people who know what they're doing, but how do you recognize this special mushroom?
This mushroom in particular is most easily identified by the smell. It has a strong smell. In fact, occasionally, if it's going well, you can smell it without even seeing the mushroom. Maybe it's under the moss or still in cracks under the soil, but you can't see a mushroom in sight, and this strong smell comes at you. And the smell affects people really differently. One of the famous mushroom identification books in California describes it as a provocative juxtaposition between red hots and dirty socks. But in Japan, this smell is considered the essence of the autumn season. It brings nostalgia and happiness. And one grocer who has a very high-end grocery store said people come into the store just to smell the smell of matsutake. People love the smell. And for me, I had to change. I started out thinking the smell was atrocious. And the first time I tried to cook with it, I just threw all the whole dinner out because I couldn't stand the smell. And then over time, I now think the smell is delightful. I can't wait to smell the smell. So a person's body can change.
It
grew on me. That's right.
Well, now, the title of your book I mentioned is The Mushroom at the End of the World, on the possibilities of life in capitalist ruins. Now, so far we've been talking about the science, the natural science of this mushroom, but you bring in this idea of capitalist ruins.
Well, some of it has to do with forestry science, that in the 1930s, a lot of trees, and then up through the end of World War II, a lot of trees were exported out of Oregon and Northern California as well for the international wood markets of various sorts, as well as domestic ones. And in most places, they were unable to get the same kind of trees to grow back. For example, ponderosa pines, a big, beautiful tree, but grew really well with the kind of fire regimes that Native Americans had in this area. But without them, it's really hard to grow ponderosa pines. So in the part of Oregon where I did most of my research, instead of ponderosas, lodgepole pines, a rather smaller tree, grew up instead. And yes, lodgepole pines are part of the forestry timber market, but they're not nearly as nice as ponderosa pines. Amazingly, once this mushroom came into its own, foresters did some economic studies and realized the mushrooms were worth more than the trees. So they've had to take a second look at these mushrooms in a place where they'd managed to get rid of that first burst of very beautiful big trees. It turns out we're really lucky that mushrooms were growing in these areas.
My guest is Anna Tsing, and she is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And her book that we're discussing, she's written other books, but the one we're talking about, The Mushroom at the End of the World, on the possibilities of life in capitalist ruins. Now, you mentioned Oregon and that you went there to do some of your research. What part of Oregon are we talking about?
It's Central Oregon in the Cascades is a big center for these kinds of mushrooms, but they do come down into Northern California and then, of course, up. But particularly in the forested mountains. And these mushrooms grow both under conifer trees like pines and spruces, but also under tan oaks and tan oaks on the coast, interestingly enough.
So if we were to take a drive up into the mountains or over to the coast, would we be able to follow our nose and find these mushrooms?
I feel so proud of myself that a few times I've done that. It's not simple, so I don't recommend it as the main way. The thing about mushrooms is they have good and bad seasons. So some years, they're all over the place. Other years, you're not going to find one to save your life. So I recommend as a way of looking for them, waiting for one of those flush years where there's just mushrooms all over, and then trying to follow that smell. When they're there, you'll smell them and see them.
Well, when you were As an anthropologist, one of the nice things I think about this field is that it spreads out into so many different areas that you can follow a particular interest and it'll still be under the umbrella of anthropology.
That's right.
And it looks like that's what you've done.
It's my favorite part about anthropology is that you can study almost anything that has to do with human beings in any way, and it counts as anthropology. So I love it that but even this mushroom took me into so many different directions, rather to my surprise. That's the other good thing about anthropology is it's a scholarly discipline that encourages researchers to move out in different directions, to follow the hints that they're getting along the trail and go in new ways.
So you followed this path that led you to investigate this particular mushroom, and you said that you didn't particularly care for it when you first tried this mushroom. But now, as I'm reading your book, some of it is hopeful. I mean, I think that's your goal. But some of it discouraged me. We human beings, did we really do that? Did you find yourself disappointed in we humans when you were doing your research?
I actually felt lucky that I had found these mushrooms as a relatively benign thing. I had been working before on tropical deforestation in Indonesia, and I was so discouraged from that research that I didn't know what to do next. So I actually felt lucky, but indeed, it brought me into scenes of trauma and environmental devastation, both humans and the world around us. So on the other hand, I mean, anyone who reads the newspaper knows how many terrible things are going on around us, both about humans and what we're doing to the natural world. So thank goodness they're mushrooms.
So you took this mushroom as an example to explain to us what we're doing. Is that an accurate assessment of your idea with this book?
Yes, I was interested in the book about this world that we've all come into from promises of progress that I think 50 years ago, people thought that the world was just going to get better and better for everybody, not just for the top elites in the world, but everyone. We were going to find ways to make wealth and well-being spring up for all of the people on Earth and that the plants and animals would respond to with fertility and health. And in the last 20 or 30 years, that doesn't seem possible anymore. We're suddenly confronted with a damaged planet and that we are going to have to figure out how to live in as best we can. So that's the predicament we're in. And so the book is indeed an exploration of this moment when the promises of progress have deserted us and we have to figure out where we want to go next.
My guest is Anna Tsing, and we're talking about her book, The Mushroom at the End of the World, on the possibilities of life in capitalist ruins. Now, there's that word capitalist. Socialist comes up in your book. Fascism comes up in your book. So what can we learn from these disciplines that you bring up?
Well, I think the rise of industrialization had a big effect on the natural world, that whether it was capitalist or socialist, when we started treating nature, that it was just a commodity and we could bundle it up and sell it off without any local implications. That's where we started to get into the trouble that we're in right now.
And I think it was good intentions. Some of you think, well, industrialization, that's good for us human beings. So that's a positive. So let's encourage this.
Correct. Yes. That's the problem, is that we thought all these schemes were helping everyone. But now we're suddenly realizing what the effects of some of these programs were that we thought were going to, you know, create well-being for everybody. But it turns out, I mean, one of the things we've really learned, it seems to me, in the last 20 years is we humans can't live without all these other creatures on Earth, the trees, the mushrooms, and everything else, the bacteria, you know, that we thought we could kill off all those bacteria and suddenly we'd never get sick again. Well, now, of course, it turns out that bacteria have gotten the best of us. Now we're not going to be able to kill them off anymore.
We used to think children, the children can't play in the dirt. We don't want children playing in the dirt.
Exactly.
They'll pick up germs.
Right. But now we realize we have to, you know, that the bacteria in our body make it possible for us to be humans and to live. So we have to learn to live better with these other residents of the earth who aren't humans.
And maybe reconsider what it means to be human.
That's right. I think so. I think instead of imagining ourselves as masters of the universe, we need to put ourselves besides mushrooms and trees and all these other denizens of our planet and start thinking about ourselves together as working together with and despite all our differences with each other as humans as well as across many species.
You know, I wonder too, because a lot of what you're saying sounds like what I feel the Native Americans were on the right track with this cohabitation, if that's the word I want to use. And I was wondering if you were led into that maybe Native American philosophy when you were doing your research.
There are a few Native Americans who I was able to spend some time with who are working in mushroom world. But the big communities that I really benefited from getting to know were the Hmong and Mien communities, many of them who live here in Northern California but go to Oregon to pick mushrooms every fall when it's the mushroom season. So it's an incredible resource here in Northern California, too, to have the kinds of cultural skills and diversity that allows us to address the natural world in different ways. So I felt very privileged to be learning alongside of really skilled masters of mushroom lore who didn't just understand matsutake, but many kinds of plants and fungi in the forest that they used in various ways for medicinal purposes or other kinds of things. So it was really a gift to be able to learn some of this.
Well, what do you think is a lesson that we should learn from your book, we human beings?
Well, at the very least, we should be paying more attention to the world around us, that before we believe the plans of great booster projects that are going to save us by changing everything, we should think about the plants, the animals, the fungi, the bacteria. Are we going to destroy their homes in a way that will blow back to us and make it impossible for us to survive? So I think we have to start paying attention. I mean, and the pleasures of that, to get to know this world of fungi, you know, for all of you who haven't had the chance to look at mushrooms, you should just go outside and see what they are because they're beautiful. They come in different colors, different smells, different kinds of appearance. It's a whole world of pleasure in front of us, but also a world that will help us understand the cautionary principles in our times. That means don't wreck it if you don't know how to fix it.
We are fortunate here in the North State, and particularly Chico, we have this beautiful park. So I think adults and children have this wonderful resource to be, can go out and take a walk in nature anytime we want to. But I feel people in cities are so removed from nature that they feel like it's their own resource to take advantage of. So I think this book will help us in that regard, Anna.
Well, thank you. I mean, I do hope, because even in the middle of a city, there's forms of life that people can get interested in. And even in the middle of the countryside, we forget all of the forms that someone last week took me to a stream and just started turning over the rocks so that I could see all the caddisfly larvae and the mayfly larvae and all the stuff which I had never really paid attention to before. And they were so cool. So all of us around us have resources that we never even look at. And I would love it if more people would take advantage of the worlds around them to notice. A colleague in Great Britain named Jennifer Gabris has written about walks they have in London to look at moss that's coming through the cracks of the sidewalk in different parts of London. Her story is about how the moss coming through the sidewalk can tell you different things, like, you know, a broken sewer there is making it rather damp, or, you know, other highway reconstruction changed the hydrology. So even in the middle of a city, there's stuff that one can look at.
Well, I think children are naturally curious when they're young. When we're young, we're naturally curious. And I think your book can perhaps encourage us to reignite that natural curiosity that we are born with.
Well, that's very much what I would like, and what getting into the world of mushrooms has done for me. I think probably here, because all over California now we have these mushroom fairs once a year where you can go and look at all the mushrooms that that group has gathered and wonder in all the different kinds and smells and colors of the mushrooms. It's a way of reinvigorating a sense of noticing the world with new eyes.
What a wonderful note to end on, Anna. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about your book, The Mushroom at the End of the World, on the possibilities of life in capitalist ruins.
Thank you.
Thanks to anthropologist Anna Tsing. And we're going to take a break, and then I'll be back with Heather Altfeld, whose award-winning essay is Obituary for Dead Languages. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Heather Altfeld is a poet and essayist. Her two books of poetry are Postmortem and The Disappearing Theater. Her essay, Obituary for Dead Languages, is in this year's edition of the 2019 Best American Essays, edited by Rebecca Solnit. And she is the 2015 recipient of the Pablo Neruda Prize for Poetry. Heather Altfeld teaches in the Department of Comparative Religion and Humanities and the Honors Program at Chico State University. Heather Altfeld, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You have had your essay chosen for this this collection of essays, Best American Essays, edited by Rebecca Solnit, and I happen to be a fan of her writing myself. How did you rate this honor?
It was a huge surprise and a very delightful one. I'm also a huge fan of Rebecca Solnit's work. I was knocked off my feet, frankly, to hear this. I was particularly surprised because usually editors don't tell you necessarily if they're submitting your essays for awards. And so I hadn't even known this essay had been submitted.
So you are contacted that your essay has been submitted. And did you submit more than one?
No. I was contacted that it won. I didn't, or that it was going to be in that year. I was contacted by Robert Atwan, who's the series editor. But no, I didn't know it had been submitted at all.
And I was so curious as to how you happened to choose to write an obituary for dead languages.
So my book that's coming out this summer, Postmortem, is a book largely speaking about things that have died or left. It's mainly set up as obituaries and kaddishes, which is, the Jewish term for mourning or orphaning. And every summer, I sort of seem to wade into a giant project, usually one that's far too large to finish. And I sort of accidentally waded into the dead languages. I was an anthropology major in college, so I had some knowledge about the issue beforehand. But the more I read, the more shocked I was about how little attention the issue has gotten.
The issue of dead languages.
Exactly.
Of languages dying.
Languages dying, languages that are endangered, which is actually a term used to describe languages that have few speakers and or no young speakers learning the language. So the more I read, the more I became attracted to it. And I had been carrying around this very large book for, as my friends know, it's called Theatrum Orbis Terrarum by Abraham Ortelius, and that's what
now,
starts this.
I'm going
to
pause for just a second because this is a little-known work, I think, and yet it was really important.
It was hugely important. This was the first complete, somewhat complete atlas of the world.
What set this guy in perspective is historically for us?
So he was, I believe he was based in Antwerp, and he designed this or you know, used this map to, it's very interesting because some of it is geographic in nature, but there's also this cultural element. So every country or sort of region, he gives you this somewhat rudimentary anthropological explanation of the peoples there. So the first part of this essay is when he speaks about the Tatars and the Ethiopians and the Congo and so forth, and with these fairly, I mean, what would be completely called, you know, ethnocentric, racist descriptions of these different cultural groups and how they lived and so forth.
My guest is Heather Altfeld, and she has won, her essay was selected as one of the best American essays included in this year's edition of the year's best essays. The reason I wanted you to explain that who you're referring to is because in your essay, your very first sentence, you jump right in and mention Ortelius, and you don't tell us who he is, but he, you say that in 1570, Theatrum Orbis Terrarum, Theater of the World. And so this guy made a pretty important contribution, and yet he's little known.
I think he's little known here in the United States. I mean, we're not exactly the capital of geographic knowledge. You know, I always joke with my students that the United States is sort of the butt of the world's jokes in terms of our geographic knowledge. I'm not sure how well known it is outside of the United States, but I don't imagine it's quite as obscure, especially in Europe, as it is here. The book is very, very large. It's probably about 2.5 feet tall, and it weighs about, I don't know, a good 18 pounds. And so my friends who've seen me with it have teased me, little Heather and her big book. But I carried it around for months because I was very intrigued by this project Ortelius had embarked on.
You know, I just imagine his being a, kind of a local hero in Belgium, and I have some Belgian friends, and I thought, gosh, I wish I had thought to ask them if he was maybe a hero in their own history. So I'm not your typical reader, Heather, because this topic fascinates me no end. I spent my graduate career studying languages, and so when you talk about Nahuatl, I thought, oh, yeah, the Aztec language, and the university I went to had taught Nahuatl.
Wow.
That's really rare, but they're not a professor. They had a linguistics professor who used an informant to help teach this language. And so I have always been interested in this sort of thing, and you have to seek out. I had to seek out a special university because most universities, if you say major in language, even English, they assume you're interested in the literature.
Right.
And so that's why I was wondering how, if you had some background in that led you to be interested in language as opposed to only literature.
I would say mostly I've approached it from an anthropological standpoint. We had to take a year of linguistics for the degree, so I did take linguistics, and I studied Romani for the second semester of that, the language that is spoken by the Roma, which are, you know, known in the West as gypsies. And I've been intrigued by this concept of languages as a colonial mechanism as well, how one language comes in and sort of replaces another language. And right now, you know, English is that language globally, but that wasn't always the case. There have been all these other languages that have come and gone. And one of the examples I use in here that I think is just particularly poignant is the language Gnanic, which was a proto Judeo-Czech, Judeo-Slavic language, which then, of course, was replaced by Yiddish, which then, of course, became an endangered language and is now flourishing to a certain degree. So kind of interesting how those take.
My guest is Heather Altfeld, and she one of her essays was selected to be included in this year's edition of Best American Essays. And the title of her essay is Obituary for Dead Languages. And Heather, the this idea that languages flourish and not, and the conqueror comes in and imposes their language. But English, even though now today we're the dominant language, our language, that wasn't always the case. And I was always intrigued by the fact that when the Normans came to England, says, okay, you're out there growing pigs, but when it gets to our table, we're going to call it pork.
Right.
So we have these dual words because for a time, our language was the suppressed language.
Sure. And English borrows from so many languages. I mean, there's many, many references that come from most language groups, at least on Earth, that have been sort of subsumed by English. So,
well, let's hear some of your essay, Heather. If you would start at the beginning, and you've already told us now, we talked about who Ortelius is and his Theatrum Orbis Terrarum. So would you read that?
Obituary for Dead Languages. Pressed with copper, inked on vellum, Ortelius's 1570 Theatrum Orbis Terrarum, the theater of the world, was an atlas of the visible, the earth as stage, the seas as audience, 160 maps graphing possibility, illuminating the desire for the unexplored. Each cartograph was legend to the coveted marvels of the known universe. Spice, salt, fur, gold, moon, salt, stars, love. The whim of elements engraved in its corners. Sun, fire, the rage of Poseidon, cold wind strapped to a mortal at sea. The boundaries, invisible to birds and despots, are marked by turrets, blurred by the rivers the dead cross alone at night. Here are the Nubian elephants. Here are the hot tents of the Tartars who used the blood of horses to slake their thirst. Here the locusts of Ethiopia who devour the corn and leave the meadows and pastures bare of grass so that the people do oftentimes leave their native soil where they were bred and born and are forced, for want of victuals, to go seek some other place to dwell on. Here is the Congo, where Ortelius says, before the entrance of the Portugals into this country, the people had no proper names, but were called by common names, such as stones, trees, herbs, birds, and other creatures. Here are the continents, once married, now divorced by the currents of the sea. Here is the terra incognita of kindness and empathy. Here are the urns you will return to after your long wanderings for power or love.
This is Heather Altfeld reading from her essay, Obituary for Dead Languages. And you have so many intriguing references in here. You mentioned, for example, Poseidon. And you kind of assume, yeah, you guys know who Poseidon was. But just in case people don't know, you might remind us.
The god of the seas. And, you know, in some of these old maps, if you see the four corners of them often are sort of guarded by different mythological figures. So.
And often maybe Poseidon, or by the Romans called him Neptune, would have a trident. And
exactly.
You'd see there in the water. And then you also, there's a section that is in italics. And what do the italics distinguish from the rest that's in regular type?
So there's a lot of italics actually throughout this entire piece, and they're all the words of other people, in this case, Ortelius. These are direct quotes from Ortelius.
So when you're reading along, you're reading what you wrote, and then you're quoting Ortelius.
Yeah, it's very difficult to have a listener, you know, hear
to
that
distinguishing
yeah. mark. But yeah. I would hope most listeners would think that, you know, I wouldn't refer to you know, the Portugals come into this country and
that's not what we would
the people
call them.
Were called by stones and trees. So
yeah, no, that wouldn't. We don't call them the Portugals today. And then you also mention, I think people are familiar, you say, with this concept. Here are the continents once married, now divorced by the currents of the sea. And I think people understand what you mean by that, but just you might clarify.
Just the concept of Pangaea and the breaking apart of the plates of the earth and each of those drifting out into their own.
Well, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid and I would look at a map of the world and I would think, golly, the Western Hemisphere and the Eastern Hemisphere fit together. There's this line that you could just push them together like jigsaw puzzle pieces. But that was never mentioned as I was growing up in school.
Yeah, I think I learned about it in fourth grade and it blew me away completely. That was the biggest news I'd ever heard in my life.
That continents could drift apart?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, let's go continue there, Heather.
Recent broadcast from the Terrarium of Sadness and Destruction. It will take between 10 and 14 days from now for another of the world's 6,900 languages to die out. So let's say that today the last speaker of Something Somewhere is dying. Exhibit A, Albin Michael. Of the 7,700,000,000 people on Earth, he was the only one left who could speak Nootchkat. He lived near Nootka Island. He spoke to his parents in dreams as there was no one left to speak to him. And then 1 year ago, he was gone, himself a dream, his language buried with him. Exhibit B, after millennia of surviving in the Caucasus Mountains on one vowel and 84 consonants, Ubik died in the grave of Tevik Esnek. He said, I see you well instead of I love you, and you cut my heart instead of you please me. The sound of his words described in a fable as the noise of a bag of pebbles poured on a sultan's marble floor.
This is Heather Altfeld reading from her essay, Obituary for Dead Languages, which was selected to be included in this year's edition of Best American Essays. After a break, I'll be continuing my conversation with Heather Altfeld about her essay, Obituary for Dead Languages. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with poet and essayist Heather Altfeld. Now, you say that another of the world's 69,000 languages to die
6,900.
Out. Excuse me.
Yeah.
6,900.
Right.
And you mentioned that this language had one vowel and 84 consonants. And I think most people assume that because our language has both vowels and consonants, that all languages have both vowels and consonants.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. Until I took linguistics, I had very little sense of how languages were built, so to speak, because phonemically, they're very, very different from each other. And sounds that we cannot make in English are made as parts of other people's languages. And, you know, these consonant-heavy languages, when we look at them, I mean, I'm quite sure I butchered the names I've used because I haven't a background in Ubique to use.
Not many people do. But the fact that people may wonder why sometimes we see the word Muslim and sometimes we see Muslim or Muhammad can be spelled more than one way. Because if you have a language without vowels and you try to put that in a language that does have vowels, you have to come up with some vowels.
Sure. And the example you just used, interestingly, I mean, there are vowels in Arabic and in Hebrew, but the vowels, the way that they're used, the letters are actually written separately from the vowels. And so a word that looks one way could be pronounced three or four different ways and have three or four different meanings. And it makes it, when you transliterate it, it's very complicated.
And we're going to skip a little bit in your essay, but you've just given us Exhibit A and Exhibit B. So let's pick up now with Exhibit C.
Exhibit C. It took 600,000 men working 43 years to build the Tower of Babel. It is said in the Torah that those in charge behaved heartlessly toward the weak and sick who could not assist in its construction. They would not even allow a woman in travail to leave the work. When God smashed the tower to smithereens, many of its builders were changed into apes, evil spirits, demons, and ghosts. The rest wandered the earth, deaf to each other, confounded, babbling 1,000 tongues, interpreters racing in the rain to explain the dreams of God. Babel is hence referred to in some texts as the mother of confusion. And barbarous, then, or barbarian, is Greek for one who babbles, while jabber pertains to sea fowl, fools, Jews, monkeys, and the Flemish.
Now, isn't this an interesting story from the Bible? This tower that people built, it said, oh, we're going to just build this tower up to God. And he says, no, you aren't.
Yeah, so. It's always been, actually, my enchantment with that particular story partly comes from the Bruegel painting, Tower of Babel, which is also a product of Antwerp, actually. And just the whole idea of this story is so interesting, right? Because it's a, in a sense, an urban legend that explains why we don't speak the same language and why we can't communicate with each other. But it's such a compelling tale to me, this idea that it took 43 years to build and that, you know, women would give birth on the ledges of the tower and then go back to carrying their bricks. I can't get it out of my head.
Well, it's interesting, too. Maybe in your linguistics course, you learned that there are certain sounds that children, no matter where in the world or what their language is, there are certain sounds that they make in the beginning when they're first learning to talk, like ma, ma, and pa, pa, da, da. And this babel doesn't come from the Tower of Babel. It comes from the fact that that's a sound that little children make when they start to talk. They babble. And so I find this whole story so interesting.
Yeah, and that back, you're right, that double meaning of Babel.
Yeah, that didn't come from this tower. It
no,
came from
no, well,
a different source. Yeah. When I mentioned that you mentioned in your essay this language of the Aztecs of Nahuatl. So can you skip now, or continue, that is, this paragraph where you say goodbye to some of these languages?
Goodbye, Thracian and Yana, Mismis and Old Burmese, Mandan and Dukhminfed, and classical Nahuatl. Farewell, Akkadian and Assyrian and Canaanic and Bidyara and Yiddish, the language Singer wrote in because he liked ghost stories. Also, I believe in the resurrection, What will all those Jews have to read when they come back to life if I don't write in Yiddish?
Now, this is Ortelius speaking.
No, this is Isaac Bashevis, Singer.
Oh, right, because it's in quotes, yeah.
Yes, yes, Singer. Farewell, Venetic and Mura and Old Norse, the languages of mint masters and tribesmen and hatters and engravers, the languages of servants and slaves and the architects of aqueducts. Goodbye, Xun, and its five interpreters, the language in which a cloud is a house for rain. Yahi didn't even have a word for goodbye. You stay, I go, Ishi told the white man who befriended him. And then he did, taking his songs and his name with him. It takes about 10 days to get the results of your lab work. In 10 days, you'll receive a courtesy call from our offices. In 10 days, your building permit will be approved by the city council.
And that last sentence is in italic, so you're again quoting.
Yes, I'm quoting from random bureaucracy.
Yes, because
nobody specifically.
Because you mentioned a building permit.
Yes. So I was trying to think of these many examples that we hear of things that will happen in 7 to 10 days' time, because, of course, that got stuck in my head as I was doing this research, that these languages are disappearing. Literally, you know, a language disappears between every 1 and 2 weeks.
Well, also the idea that if we have a word for goodbye, then these other languages must have a word for goodbye. And you say, nope, because Ishi, and you might explain who Ishi is for people who need a little reminder.
Well, Ishi was known as the last wild Indian in North America.
We'll put that in quotes.
That's put in quotes, absolutely. He was starving and alone after all of his people had been wiped out, the Yana and the Yai.
And this is right here in California, right here in our back door.
It's actually about 20 miles from here as the crow flies. And he surrendered himself as he was starving at a slaughterhouse in Orville, and was promptly put in jail because they didn't really know what to do with him. And, you know, he was written in the jail ledger as Indian, wild. They didn't know what to do with him because it had been a while before anybody had actually seen an Indian.
My guest is Heather Altfeld, and she's been reading from her essay, and the title of the essay is Obituary for Dead Languages, and this essay was selected to be included in this year's edition of Best American Essays for 2019. So let's go on now to when you say, you talk about greed in your essay.
Greed defines us, even when we try to call it love. It is still wanting, still inhalation, still one mouth sucking on and spitting out the world like bones, the planet's marrow, one long banquet of planked sturgeons and roasted pheasants. Such continents to swallow, such rivers to burp. If not Mussolini, Stalin. If not Stalin, you. It is so easy to pretend there is an order to things, an extant plan to determine who breathes and who dies, a diagram explaining to the unwitting mothers why some are breeding fascists and others Plutarchs when the wombs look virtually the same. The only sense that can be made of it all comes not through God, but through midnight conversations with the ghost of Lucretius, who tells you that music was meant for the heavens and not to inspire blood. Whenever I speak Tlingit, I still taste the soap, says one tribal elder, remembering how his grandmother would rub the suds into his gums, the tiny clean bubbles of English rising toward the ceiling, carried on his hiccup toward the unreachable sky.
Earlier, you were mentioning exhibits, and you read us about Exhibit A, B, C, and next you cover Exhibit D.
Exhibit D. Two old women sit stiffly on a small upholstered sofa somewhere in Alaska. I worked real hard on fish today, one says improbably to the other. You rest, the other responds. I eat today, one says into the camera. Seaweed, salmon, berries, bread, hooligan grease, potatoes, tea. Tastes really good. The other smiles, speaks to the videographer in English. These are some of the only words they still know in the moribund language of Haida. Soon, they will be dead, but will leave behind a partial dictionary and a YouTube video of their conversation.
This is essayist and poet Heather Altfeld, and she is reading from her essay, Obituary for Dead Languages. Now, this paragraph about these two old women sitting on a sofa in Alaska, and you do mention on video, so you must have actually seen this video.
Oh, yes. It's on YouTube. Last I checked, it was still on YouTube.
And so you were able to write down their very – so this is also in italics because
Correct.
You're quoting these two women. And they mentioned – now, seaweed, salmon, berries, bread, that sounds good. But hooligan grease, Heather? What in the world is hooligan grease?
I've not really been able to figure that out. And it touches on one of the – things you were talking about just a minute ago with like not having a word for goodbye or, you know, there are these ways of expressing things that are very particular to our ways of thinking in the world. The way we think about time and distance are very particular to our culture. They're totally bound to us by culture. And so these words or expressions that have a use or explanation in the environment and the topography, language, their way of binding the people and their ideas and their ways of thinking about the world. So I don't know what hooligan grease is. And actually, I kind of like not knowing because I feel like that's this tiny morsel that should belong to them. I don't have to have it directly translated.
Well, this, and you mentioned this, they talk about this language. And I think that if we only speak one language, that's our view of the world
Absolutely.
Through that language. And I had a friend who lives in Chico who his first language is Danish. And so I asked him if he was teaching when his children came along, if he was teaching them Danish. And he says, oh, nobody speaks Danish. I thought, oh, what a beautiful opportunity. I would have loved to have grown up in a house where anything I know about a foreign language, I had to sit down and learn verb forms and declensions, spend hour after hour. And here he could have just given his children this beautiful opportunity to see the world in a different way.
I think that's one of the most enormous tragedies of assimilation and homogenization that, you know, that, well, it's not very many people speak it, so it's not useful. It's not marketable or it's not, why would he need that? Why would my children need that? And I think that there's a lot lost when people can't or don't teach their children that.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you about one of my favorite subjects, Heather. And we will look forward to your next book of poetry, Postmortem. Is coming out soon, so we look forward to that. Your previous poetry collection, The Disappearing Theater. And this morning, thank you for coming in and telling us about Obituary for Dead Languages.
Thank you so much for having me, Nancy.
I would also like to thank my first guest, anthropologist Anna Tsing.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.